Welcome to ASAP Nowcast with our medical editor-in-chief, Dr. Cedric Dark.
Hi, this is Cedric Dark, and with me today are Drs. Ken Milne, the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine, and Jevi Stone, an Olympian and emergency medicine resident at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston. We're going to start with Dr. Milne discussing one of his recent articles in ASAP Now about whether or not we need to change the duration of therapy for treating pneumonia in children. So with us is Dr. Ken Milne. He's the author of Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine, and we're going to talk about his September article, which focuses on antibiotics for community-acquired pneumonia in the pediatric population. How many days are we supposed to treat these kids? 5 days, 10 days? The evidence is changing on that, and the guidelines traditionally say 10 days right now, but Dr. Milne will tell us whether or not we need to change what we do in practice. So let me give you a quick little recap from the IDSA guidelines, which number one says we don't need to do chest x-rays on all these kids. We don't always have to do that, so that's a good thing to know. Number two, don't treat preschool age children, so really young children you don't necessarily have to treat because it tends to be viral and not bacterial in nature, but do treat school age kids. And with that, let me bring in Dr. Milne to give us a little bit about the study that he was reviewing and tell us what we can learn from it.
Sure. And just to clarify, when you say treating, you're talking about treating with antibiotics, because of course we would give symptomatic management to those preschoolers. And even if we are giving antibiotics to the older children, we would treat them symptomatically. So I just want to make sure that we're clear that we're talking about, we don't have good evidence to use antibiotics in the preschool age group, because the vast majority of these are viral. But this new study, which was called the SAFER randomized clinical trial published in JAMA, was asking a very specific question. It was asking, hey, do we have to go the traditional 10 days, or can we cut that back to just 5 days? Because there is some weak evidence with a small randomized control trial that had just over 100 children that reported that 5 days of amoxicillin at 80 milligrams per kilogram divided TID was non-inferior to 10 days in children 6 to 59 months of age. And there's also the adult literature looking at the American Thoracic Society and the IDSA saying that under certain circumstances, adults can be only treated for 5 days. So I think that's where the hypothesis generating to do the SAFER trial came in. And so they took some children 6 months to 10 years of age who were diagnosed with community-acquired pneumonia, but they're well enough to be treated as an outpatient. So these aren't the sick kids. These are the children that are well enough to go home. And the intervention was to give them 5 days of high-dose amoxicillin, high-dose being 90 milligrams per kilogram, and then that was followed by 5 days of placebo, because that was the intervention group. And the comparison, the traditional group, what they were comparing to was that 10 days of high dose, 90 milligrams per kilogram. And they wanted to see for their primary outcome in 2 to 3 weeks, how many children met that clinical cure rate. And so they randomized 281 children into the trial. The median age was about 2.5 years of age. And the key result was 5 days of antibiotics was inferior to 10 days of antibiotics with children with community-acquired pneumonia. But there's some nuance there, and so I hope we can get to that. And one more thing before we jump into that nuance, I do want to say, I would never want to tell other practitioners, other clinicians how to practice. All I want to do is to help you digest the literature, but then you have to apply your clinical judgment and engage with the patients in shared decision-making often to find out what their preferences and values are.
I think this is a very interesting point that you bring up, because you said that the study itself essentially found out that the 5 days was inferior to 10 days. And this particular type of study is a non-inferiority trial, which is something that we've seen a lot more frequently in the literature. And I think, first of all, it's important that our readers understand what this type of trial is, because people are used to studies that actually are comparing drug A versus drug B, or intervention A versus intervention B, and saying which one is better, which one's worse. But a non-inferiority trial is different.
Yeah, they're looking for superiority. And this is a non-inferior, which is it not worse than what we're already doing? And does it have some other advantage? And in this case, of course, not exposing to children to 5 days of unnecessary antibiotics.
So I think that's a great way to describe it. We're actually doing a not worse study, essentially. Is 5 days not worse than 10 days? And they do this usually by setting up a particular margin of inferiority, which for this particular trial, it technically failed to meet that non-inferiority margin. But when you look at the numbers, the differences, as you point out, 88.6% of the kids got better with 5 days, 90.8% got better with 10 days.
Yeah, they got this teeny tiny difference, right? So let's just say 90% of kids get better regardless. And there may be about a 1% difference between the two. But then they have this one-sided confidence interval for non-inferiority, and they set it at 7.5%. And so they said, does that lower end, even though the point estimate is only like 1.2%, does that lower end of that confidence interval around that point estimate breach 7.5? And it does. It goes down to 8.7. So it's, 1.2% difference. Statistically, you cannot claim non-inferiority. You have to say, yeah, it was inferior. It breached the point that we decided at 7.5. If they decided that it was 10%, they would have said, see, this is non-inferior, because that margin didn't exceed it. But does that really make a clinical difference when 90% of the kids are better?
And I think that's a great point, because reading through your article, it almost seems like you would say, go ahead and just do the 5 days as opposed to the 10. Is that how you're going to start practicing now?
So I would approach the parents and do the shared decision-making using the three pillars of emergency medicine and say, hey, here's the literature. 90% of children will do well. There's about a 1% to 2% chance that a child will need 10 days. Okay, so there's about a 1% to 2% difference in there. And then I use my clinical judgment, but then I reach out to the parents and say, there are some parents that are very antibiotic resistant, like they don't want to give their children antibiotics. They're like, no, my child's never been on antibiotics and I don't want them to be on a pharmaceutical. And then there are the other end of the spectrum are like, oh yeah, no, we got to make sure this is fixed because daycare or childcare or school or whatever. And that's their preference and priority. Some children, oh, they're allergic to a number of medicines and they're very sensitive. Other children get a lot of diarrhea, and you'd have to explain that 90 milligrams per kilogram, there might be a lot of diarrhea. And so forming that discussion with the parents and say, there's not a big clinical difference here. What do you want to do? That's how I would do it.
That's a good approach. What I tend to do is I look at my phone, my smartphone, pull up my app and be like, what does the app say to do in terms of course? And I looked at it and it's like, oh, it tells me the 10 days. So I guess the question from this is, are we going to see guidelines start to change, or the IMRA antibiotic guideline or something along those lines, where the average doc that's just trying to look up what they need to do for a particular condition that they may see all the time. I don't see a lot of kids in my shop because we're mostly an adult hospital. How long to do that treatment course? How long do you think that's going to take to change?
If I'm going to be evidence-based, I'd have to say 17 years, because there's a nice study that says how long does it take high-quality, clinically relevant information to reach the patient's bedside when you've got robust evidence incorporated into guidelines that most clinicians are practicing that way. 17 years. I usually say greater than 10 years. So I don't think it's going to change fast. But I think with social media and what you're doing right now is trying to reach a broader audience with ASAP Now. We put this out electronically. People get a paper copy. But now you're giving them a way to access this knowledge translation in another way. And so we may be able to cut that KT window down, that knowledge translation window down, from over 10 years to less than 1 year by just listening to this ASAP Now edition.
Yeah, and I think we've seen this past year and a half or so, we've cut the time to get knowledge from the bench to the bedside has dramatically changed with COVID, and maybe something that we can do as well for something like this. Last thing I wanted to ask you about is really just the risks and benefit of practicing on the cutting edge, because when I read your articles, they always seem to be cutting edge things that we should be changing or consider changing about our practice. So what kind of thoughts do you have for the listener about the risks and benefit of being on the tip of the spear?
I don't know if it's on the tip of the spear per se, because of course, you know, this stuff has been researched, as in, you know, the study was started a few years ago, it's worked its way through the system, and by the time it goes through peer review, there's a delay. But I understand what you're saying there. What I think people should take away is to have open, transparent conversations about the literature with their patients on a regular basis. So when they say 5 to 10 days, and then engage with the patients and say, we could consider going to 5 days. It seems reasonable to go to 5 days if you would prefer that, because we honor the patient's values and preferences as long as it's reasonable within what the literature says, and as long as you as a clinician are clinically confident in that approach as well. So again, I don't want to change people's practice. What I want to do is make them think. I don't want to tell them what to think, but I'd really like to teach them how to think with looking at this critical appraisal of this literature, because there are some other limitations in this study. It was done in some Canadian hospitals. I don't know if that's going to apply to American hospitals. I don't know if it's going to apply outside of a pediatric emergency medicine department, because these were all tertiary ped centers. They were not community hospitals. You don't see a lot of kids in your hospital. What about the rural or critical access hospitals? How does it apply to them? This is silent on that, and we don't know. We would have to extrapolate from this data. But I think there's one really important point. Since you're talking about being the tip of the spear, I'm going to give the list a little teaser here. You ready for this? What about, maybe I should give a trigger warning. If you're listening to this, pull over. Sit down, because this might shock you. This trial looked at 10 days versus 5 days. What about, I'm thinking of a nice round number, what about 0 days of antibiotics? For someone who's diagnosed with pneumonia, and they did chest x-rays on a lot of these children, and you don't need to do chest x-rays, but a chest x-ray can tell you, oh, there's a fuzziness in there. It doesn't tell you whether it's bacterial or viral, does it? And also, even if it is bacterial, are we talking about, will that decrease or increase their clinical cure rate? We know from strep throat treatments and antibiotics, instead of 7 day, you'll be better 1 day sooner. What is the delta on treating children with antibiotics, with community acquired pneumonia, that are clinically diagnosed well enough to go home? 0 days. And there's a trial underway. Stay tuned, because I have heard, my finger is on the pulse, that this might be published soon with a group that got 0 days of antibiotics.
That would certainly be fascinating to read. So looking forward to that in one of your future columns with us. And as you like to say, remember to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it on Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. And that will do for today. Thanks so much for spending your time with ASEP Nowcast. Hope to see you in the future.
I look forward to doing another one of these with you, Cedric.
So with me now is Dr. Jevi Stone from Beth Israel Deaconess EM Residency, a Harvard-affiliated residency program in Boston, Massachusetts. And we wanted to discuss the article that she is in the September issue of ASEP Now, where we talk about her trials in Olympic rowing. So the article starts out pretty interestingly with an explanation of how you chose emergency medicine. And I'm going to read a little quote from that. You say, "I realize that this is what I get to do every day in the emergency department, help people and manage chaos. This came out one day when you were trying to get a bunch of summer campers out of the water ahead of a storm. What do you remember about that day and why it made you choose emergency medicine?"
Well, first, thanks for having me. So the day actually happened just about a year into residency. During medical school, I always thought that I was going to go into orthopedics. And I was on the plane back from the Rio Olympics ahead of applying, so about a 1 month prior to applications being due, and had a moment where I realized that I needed to have rowing in my life in some way, shape, or form, because the more I did it, the more I loved it, and that orthopedics wouldn't allow that. And emergency medicine is filled with people who have interests outside of medicine, in addition to medicine. So I told my dean, you know, I actually think I want to apply an emergency. I'm sure this is what I want to do. And the more I thought about it, the more I realized it was the right fit for me. Did my intern year, was very happy with it. But then during interviews, we got asked if we could do one job that wasn't in the medical profession. Which profession would you choose? And I chose being a camp counselor, which is not a full-time job, unfortunately, and not a year-round job. But I did spend 11 summers at this all-girls camp, including 3 as a counselor, and loved the teaching, the mentoring, the atmosphere, the attitude, the focus on character, and would happily go back to that job if it were full-time. I went back to visit camp after my intern year to the place where I was very happy as a counselor, and we had this day on the waterfront where the storm rolled in, and once everyone was on the beach and safe, one of the counselors was talking about how these days stress her out and she doesn't like them. She'd prefer everything to just go smoothly, and I begged to disagree and said, I love these days. I mean, these are the days that challenge us when everything happens that you don't expect, and managing the obstacles and coming out on the other side with cheerful, healthy, happy campers is kind of the best outcome, overcoming that challenge and coming out healthy. And as I said this, I realized that that's what I do every day. I mean, they're not campers, obviously, and we're not on a lake, but you never know what's going to come in that door. And it's usually a little bit chaotic and you have to adapt to the situation. But at the end of the shift, the goal is to get as many patients dispoed safely and, I mean, hopefully happily, but that is not always a guarantee, as we all know, in the emergency department, and do it as a team. And I think that is one of the big things as well that drew me to emergency medicine was at camp, it's all the counselors working together to get the campers through it as safely and happily and cheerfully as we can. And in the department, it's all the doctors and nurses and techs and the entire staff working together to achieve a very similar goal.
All right. Well, you had to take a break from your primary focus, which is medicine, in order to train for the Olympics. And this sounded like, from reading the article, maybe a couple years ago, where you actually had to begin this training regimen. What's that like? And do you feel like training for the Olympics is easier or harder than training for medicine?
I'll start with the first part, because that's the easier question to answer. I knew from past experience, having been to 2 Olympics, that it really takes about 2 years of full-time training to be ready to compete at the Olympic level in terms of gaining the fitness and then gaining the competitive experience within that Olympic quadrennial. So I approached my program director in December of 2017 when I had just started and said, I think I want to take time off. I'm 6 months into residency and I already want a break. I explained the whole thing and he was very understanding, and I explained how 2 years really is necessary. And 2 years, unfortunately, became 3 because of COVID. So it was a longer break than anticipated. In terms of what is harder, the grass is always greener on the other side of the fence. I think that when rowing, I miss the things in emergency medicine. I miss the mental challenges. I miss feeling like I have energy in my extremities every day. I miss being able to move my back. But of course, when I'm working in the department, I miss having a job that's outside all the time and being able to take naps and eat 5,000 calories a day. They both are very challenging, and I obviously, it's why I picked emergency medicine. I enjoy those challenges, and they're challenging in different ways, but also similar in that they both require a lot of grit and a lot of perseverance. And then the little benefits are very different.
Are your arms more tired after a day of rowing or after a day of inputting data into an EMR?
Oh, well, I would have to say the rowing then. It's been amazing. Even just riding my bike to commute, I actually can ride it as opposed to just barely pushing the pedals along due to fatigue and it not being one of my scheduled workouts.
Gotcha. Now, 2020 hit pretty much right as the Olympics were getting ready to go. The pandemic struck. What did that sort of make you feel, I guess, in terms of like your athletic career conflicting with your medical career, that sort of thing? Because in the article, you discuss a little bit about what some people might talk about pandemic guilt, almost, where, you know, you were getting not quite accolades, but I guess a lot of input from the general community for being a physician.
But at the time, you weren't really on that front line like your classmates were.
Yeah, I certainly, when COVID hit, was struggling with the Olympic postponement, for one, and the possibility that I might not get to compete at this stage that I've taken 2 years off to aim for, but also certainly a feeling of guilt that I had taken the Hippocratic Oath. I trained in medical school. The reason that we become physicians is to help people, especially in times of crisis like the pandemic, and I wasn't helping people. And one of the first things I did was to contact my program and say, I'm happy to come back if you need me. I mean, I'm trained. I am a physician. I'm ready. I'm ready to help out where you need a set of hands. And as you know, emergency medicine was kind of weirdly hit by the pandemic in that our volumes were actually down despite the hospitals being full. And reflecting on that and on the risk of my getting sick, the program said, we really think you should focus on rowing for now and come back after the Olympics. Hopefully the Olympic happens in the summer of 2021, which fortunately it all worked out. The Olympics did happen and now I get to be a doctor again. But I definitely had moments talking to my friends where I just said, you're helping people every day and I'm rowing.
It's definitely a better recruiting tool, I think, for them to say we had someone in the Olympics than we had one more extra doctor. So how was Tokyo, though? You know, I remember reading over the summer there were some protests around the time of the Olympics. The people there were not really happy to have the risk of another outbreak brought on by the athletes. So did you ever feel a conflict between your role as a physician and your role as an athlete when it came to that?
We didn't see much of that conflict. I read about it in the American papers, but we were very sequestered in the Olympic Village and at our venues. Athletes could only travel to their specific venue and stay within the village on very separate buses from the general public. We wore masks everywhere, including outside. We were tested every day, and they had very strict quarantine rules. I think someone wrote a paper, an article on how we were the most tested, most protocoled community anywhere in the world. I think it was managed appropriately. And coming into the Olympics, we were getting information from the U.S. Olympic and Paralympic Committee about the testing we were going to go through and the rigor of it, which definitely made me feel better about traveling to Japan, given that we were going to be tested. We were all vaccinated on the rowing team. We were going to be tested multiple times prior to travel and then every day on arrival and then every day thereafter. I think they did a good job controlling the disease. I don't think that any outbreaks... There were a few people who tested positive, but no outbreaks in Tokyo due to internationals coming in.
So it was as safe as it possibly could be, considering the circumstances.
Yes, exactly.
All right. Well, just last quick question here. What does the future hold for you?
I need to finish residency. That is the number one thing on the table. I started the medical process a long time ago and was dating myself a recent shift when I told an intern that I loved an ice cream place that I used to call and listen to the voicemail for the flavors daily when I was in Berkeley one summer during college, and he and the other residents looked at me very confused, and I had to explain to them that yes, I went to college before smartphones when we called up the ice cream place to listen to the voicemail to hear the ice cream flavors. Finishing residency is certainly first on the table. I'm currently an EM2 and set to graduate in the spring of 2023. And then hopefully a sports medicine fellowship. I would love to ultimately practice emergency medicine in probably a community setting, maybe an academic setting, and also be one of the U.S. rowing team doctors and travel to competitions with the team and stay connected with the sport that way and be able to merge my two passions.
Well, a lot of luck to you. You probably can put this interview and this article right at the front page of your applications for a fellowship. All right, Dr. Jevi Stone, thank you very much for joining us here with ASAP Now.
Thanks for having me on.
Many thanks to my guests this month, Dr. Milne and Dr. Stone, for joining me and discussing their articles in the September issue of ASAP Now. See you next month.
ACEP Now is published by Wiley and is a product of the American College of Emergency Physicians. The views expressed on ACEP Nowcast are those of the hosts and any guests. The music is Florence Price's Fantasy No. 1 in G minor for violin and piano. Thanks for listening.